Welcome to episode 3 of How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams. I'm your host, author Emily White. Tonight, we are going to be talking about getting your business affairs together. But quickly, I want to thank Downtown Music Holdings for presenting this episode. Downtown's mission is to shift the power center of the music industry into the hands of those who create and those who support that creation by giving them the finest and most comprehensive set of tools and services. Downtown is committed to building a more equitable music business. They believe in partnership, advocacy, and helping musicians develop sustainable careers so they don't require their artists to give up any of their copyrights. Okay, so welcome back. To recap what we have covered so far, we've gotten our art together in episode 1 with Vernon Reed of Living Color. So I'm kidding, obviously, but in the past few days, you've got your songs together, you're starting to get ready to record, you're thinking about art that's true to your heart, your soul, and your spirit. And last week, I talked about pre-recording marketing foundation and monetizing your music before it's even out. So this morning, I woke up to an Instagram post followed by an email from Noel Gallagher of Oasis, who is one of my favorite artists. They announced, and this is being recorded in January, they announced a June release with a 6-month pre-order. So I could instantly pre-order Noel's album through a variety of price points that had gorgeous artwork and formats from CD to cassette to deluxe vinyl, ranging from $10 to $40, which also included tickets to his upcoming tour. So this is a huge artist who doesn't necessarily need the money. I mean, those Wonderwall royalties, you know, I can only imagine what that looks like. Yet Noel and his team are doing it right. And I can also only imagine how much revenue they'll be generating between now and June before the album is even out. So I hope that helps to hammer home some of what I was trying to get across on Saturday. Start monetizing your music before it's even out. I can even forward that email to some of you. It was just perfectly executed with everything that I was trying to teach you on Saturday, right? Like I did see it on social media, but if I didn't, I got the email because I'm on Noel's email list. There was a price point that covered everything. I was like falling for every part of it, ready to spend over $100. There was cool bundles. You could even put together your own bundle. And again, the revenue they are going to generate over the next 6 months is all before the album is even out. So please keep that in mind, and I hope that helps to illustrate and illuminate what we were talking about on Saturday. But let's get to today's topic. So we're talking get your business affairs together. And before I bring out our guest, who is the distinguished Carl Folks Esquire, managing partner of the Folks Firm and co-founder COO of Eagle, what is business affairs? In the music industry, business affairs means legal, basically. You know, like your copyrights, your legal agreements. I would say it also means money and accounting. We're going to talk a little bit more. Well, we're going to be talking about revenue streams throughout this podcast, and we'll have a revenue stream specific podcast episode later in the season. And we'll also talk about accounting and business management in our final episode. So today we're really honing in on legal, on that part of business affairs. But when you hear that term, business affairs thrown around, they're talking about legal and accounting. So also before Carl comes on, I want to give some basics on the two main rights in music. Does anyone here know the two main rights in music? It's totally understandable if you don't, because many of you are one person, and I'm kind of giving it away, that makes music and also writes music. I could put Oscar on the spot because he goes to Berkeley. So what are the two main rights in music?
The terminology may be slightly off, but there's publishing and the master recordings.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you, Oscar. Good job, Berkeley. Good job, Oscar. Yeah, exactly. So there's two main rights in music. There's the recording and there's the songwriting, also known as the publishing. And so what we're talking about there is if you get offered $1,000 for a sync placement, and we'll have a whole episode about sync, but sync is short for synchronization. So that means matching your music to picture in film, in a commercial, on a TV show. So say you get offered $1,000, $500 is going to be for the recording, and $500 is for the songwriting, which again, I've met artists in their 30s that have been making music for years that didn't learn that until they were an adult, because it's like, oh, well, I've been writing and recording music and I'm one person. But that's an important fundamental to understand when it comes to legal and business affairs in the music industry. I'm also going to give a quick overview on label structures, which, you know, with what I just talked about with recording and songwriting, you know, I think everyone, I don't mean to assume, but I think everyone here owns those rights. The vast majority of artists are not on a label. So when you own your recordings and you own your songwriting, you get 100% of that $1,000, right, that comes in from my hypothetical sync placement. I'm generalizing when I talk about label deals, but I just want to illustrate kind of the big picture so you understand what's out there and when you are getting offered some of these deals. So independent labels generally receive 50% of your recordings. That can totally vary. Some of the more established indies are going to take, you know, closer to 80%. But generally, like a true independent label is going to keep 50% of your recordings. Sometimes they own the recording in perpetuity. What does perpetuity mean? Anyone? Yeah?
Forever.
Yes, that's exactly right. Others are going to be a license where you get the rights back when you give notice. That's very important, and we'll do deeper dives on this later. When you give notice after a few years and are fully recouped. And recouped means whatever money the label spent, that's been made back through recordings and syncs and generating income. An indie label may also offer you a publishing deal and put a little pressure on you to sign that. I personally like to have publishing separate from a label to expand the team. You can also hold on to your publishing by letting an indie know that you have an administrator already, a publishing administrator, which you can do through SongTrust. And we'll dig into music publishing. We're going to have a whole episode on it, called Music Publishing Isn't Scary or Confusing, coming up in episode 5. But that's something I've done when an indie label, you know, we're doing a deal with an indie label and they're putting a little pressure on to do publishing. I say, oh, well, their publishing is already administered. I don't generally say it's with SongTrust, because then it's like, oh, well, you can get out of that. But I think it's good to expand the team. Major labels, more often than not, and again, all of this is negotiable, depending on your leverage, a major label will keep roughly 80% or 85% of income on recordings forever, and will also want to own or have a cut on all of your rights moving forward, not limited to publishing, merchandise, touring, branding, sponsorship, and more. And again, it totally depends on your leverage. I'm speaking generally. I mean, if you're a brand new artist, you might get 10% from a major label. I interviewed Freddie Gibbs' manager, Lambo, a few years ago. They worked their butts off for a good decade, you know, self-releasing and doing independent releases, and that has given them the leverage to license their releases to major labels, so they still own their recording rights. At the same time, you know, I wanted to give you kind of that big picture overview, but it actually bothers me in academic situations where it's like, you know, should you go with a label or should you not go with a label? I'm like, well, do you have an offer on the table or not, right? So the vast majority of artists are self-releasing, which means they own their recordings, which is also extremely empowering and not something that artists, you know, give or take Fugazi or Ani DiFranco had access to in the pre-digital era. So there are massive artists, you know, Macklemore is a great example, who own their recordings, own their rights, and then again, keep 100% of that revenue. So now on to our guest for today. Carl Folks Esquire has successfully negotiated touring contracts, record label agreements, publishing deals, merchandise, and management agreements throughout the entertainment industry. Carl's also a certified NBPA player agent under Firm Sports. Over the course of just a few years, his firm, the Folks Firm, has negotiated over a combined $45 million worth of deals for artists, music producers, joint ventures, and innovative record companies. His firm's clients include talent that have amassed billions of streams, RIAA certifications, that's the Record Industry Association of America, so that's going to be platinum and gold records, Grammy Awards, and appreciation from the likes of Forbes, Rolling Stone, OK Player, Business Insider, Trapital, Complex, ESPN, Think Tank, Variety, Billboard, and more. Carl has also been recognized as a 2020 Diverse Representation Rising Star, 2021 Variety Legal Impact Report nominee, 2021 Variety Top Music Attorney. It keeps going. He's made the National Black Lawyers 40 Under 40 list, is a 2021 Hits Daily Double Noisemaker, and 2021 Bloomberg Law 40 Under 40. I am so excited to welcome Carl Folks Esquire. Welcome, Carl.
Happy to be here.
All right. How's it going?
I'm good. Another day in the music industry, but I'm ready to try to drop some gems.
Love it. How's Los Angeles?
LA's colder than usual. It's like 59 degrees, 60 degrees. So not the typical sunshine.
See, it's not so bad here in Milwaukee. 40 degrees today. It's just like LA. So there you go.
It's just like LA.
Exactly. So let's start at the beginning. You began your career in corporate law and international business before teaching music business and hip hop culture while also opening your own firm. So I know that's a lot, but what prompted this evolution?
Yeah, I like to start that I'm not really a music guy. I never wanted to necessarily work in music. It wasn't a childhood dream or anything like that. My initial plan when I got to law school was to definitely be in the entertainment industry, but more on the sports side. So, negotiating deals for athletes, basketball players, soccer players, things of that nature. And it was really, as anyone might know, especially, in the Midwest or some of the regions outside of the
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The bigger capitals, and I'm from South Jersey, right outside of Philly for context, the industries aren't there, right? The amount of job opportunities aren't there. So it was really tough for me to even get an internship or anything like that. So when I graduated law school, I just wanted transactional law experience. I wanted to learn how to negotiate, wanted to learn how to be a good lawyer, and I kind of wanted to start there. And it was just friends and A&Rs and people like that who I knew in the music business who were just kind of always putting that bug in my head. Hey, there's not that many entertainment attorneys. There's not that many knowledgeable entertainment attorneys. I think this is something you should try out. And that was kind of my entry point in.
I love that. I mean, we need, in my opinion, experience from other fields. So I could see where your friends and colleagues would say, hey, bring that unique perspective to our industry, because it's definitely needed and is very apparent throughout your career. That's for sure. So you're also a managing partner at Firm Sports. I work in sports as well, although I'm definitely more on the music side. And so I get this question a lot. What are the differences between working in sports and music? I'm so fascinated by what your experience has been.
Well, I think music's more of the wild, wild west. There's less commonality and, there's no CBA. There's no, agreement amongst major labels or any indie labels or anything like that. There's no governing body kind of controlling the space other than, the United States Copyright Office or law or legislation. So it's definitely more of a wild, wild west. And I think in the sports world, it's lot more governance, a lot more rules you gotta you have to follow, you know, some of the same stuff, you know, goes on. But because of the Wild Wild West and the room for innovation, in a lot of ways, I feel like music's a better space to be in for entrepreneurship, just because there are less red tape, you know, less even qualifications per se, than I think you have to have in sports. In sports, there's so many just massive players like WME, CAA, Octagon that just have been doing it for such a long time. You know, music, you know, I could have a buddy, you know, two towns over who's making music in his room, and now I'm a manager. So the entry points are a lot different.
Yeah, and WME is William Morris Endeavor. CAA is also a big talent agency. And Octagon, I've worked with Octagon a lot in the sports realm, but do they do anything else besides sports or just sports?
I think they do entertainment across. I know they do marketing. I know they take, when I was in undergrad going into law school, I actually took a job with Octagon. And they do the marketing experiences for companies like BMW, Audi, things like that. So it's like a marketing agency too.
That makes sense. And not to get too off track, but I've worked with them in the Olympic space, so I could see where they would translate a lot of those relationships into deals with Olympians. So that's very cool. You know, you bring up such a good point that music is the wild, wild west. And I really just want to emphasize that because, you know, a lot of times sometimes I'll see like a 20-year-old running a label and offering a really old school deal. And I kind of get the vibe. It's like, oh, well, that's how it's been. So that's how it is. So I really just want to echo what Carl said. Like, you really can create your own destiny here, because we're not as beholden to certain, you know, standards. And like you said, existing organizations in the sports industry. But that said, is there anything we as the music industry can learn from the sports business?
Yeah, I definitely think there needs to be more governance as a group. You know, it's tough just because of the way you could equate the major leagues to the major labels in some ways, but they're so different in so many different ways. So it's harder to create more governance and rules that we all need to follow. But I think whether it be the NCAA, which has been obviously a poorly run organization for some time, but the idea of the NCAA, the idea of the collective bargaining agreements between players and leagues, those things make a ton of sense, right? If all major label artists were to have a artist a lobbying agent, right? Like, and they were one side and the major labels were another side, there could really be some progress, I think, that could be made on a joint front in regards to some of the deals that happened in the space. But right now, it's everybody for yourself. And there's always, you know, as much as we wish people wouldn't take bad deals and do janky stuff, that stuff happens all the time. There's always going to be somebody willing to take those deals because they might need the money, or you know, their family sick, or you know, wherever they're at. So I would love to see some more organizing inside of music to raise the sophistication and the standards through unionizing or lobbying or, you know, whatever needs to take place.
We're going to dig a little bit more into this later, but I can't resist. What is just a general example of a bad deal in music?
Yeah, I think a bad deal is one that doesn't stand the test of time, you know, generally speaking. But, you know, I always talk about, I use a phrase called LOMO that I developed. It's a strategy. It's length, obligation, money, and ownership. And I think those four things sort of are the key tiers of an agreement, right? And you could prioritize those things very different, right? Length might not be as important to you as initial money. Or ownership might be more important than everything. So anytime I'm kind of dealing with clients, I kind of ask them to rank those things, because you're not really going to get favorable terms on all four fronts. Like, right, if you want a bigger budget, you're probably not going to get a short deal. They're going to want it's a longer term investment. If you don't want as much money, you're going to have a lot of flexibility as it relates to, if you don't want your terms can be a lot more flexible, right? So I think thinking in terms of LOMO and kind of the four key elements in an agreement, you know, you get to kind of decide your own fate. So for everyone, a bad deal is different. But I think generally speaking, I would say really long deals that have spotty accounting and don't sort of require much or have any strong obligation from the label side, they generally don't stand the test of time. And you're seeing it now.
100%. And I can't resist because I have seen this and been horrified before. We'll talk more about this in the publishing episode. But there are still co-publishing deals that will get offered to you that want to own your songwriting forever with no advance, with no money up front. I've only seen that come out of Nashville, but please don't ever sign that, frankly. And, you know, like, I just want to reiterate, like what Carl said before, like, you don't have to take any of these deals. Like, I know it's exciting and you want to do it, but we are not beholden to standards in the sports industry, you know, for better and for worse, right? So don't let someone pressure you into something like, oh, well, this, you know, this is how it is. So you
and,
are-
And I'll yeah, add-
Please.
I'll add one quick note. I mean, one of my little phrases is, you know, no deal is better than a bad deal. It's really, really hard to get out of a bad deal, right? Like, you know, you got to be willing to litigate it, you know, do whatever it takes to get out of it. And that could be long. It could ruin your momentum. It could be exhausting. You know, lawsuits, those, they get thrown out a lot. Hell, I'll sue you. But it's an emotionally taxing process. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people account for that. So no deal is always better than a bad deal. It's really hard to get out of bad deals.
It's so true. And I was just reminded of an utter horror story that hopefully would never happen in this era, but this wasn't that long ago. There was an artist named Poe that I really loved in the late 90s, and her first album had a radio hit. Her second album got bigger, and then, you know, she was on a major, and this is like early 2000s, so everything is getting sold to each other, and it's sold. And then her rights were available at auction for her recordings, for her name and for likeness. And a stalker bought them and she was unable to record under the name Poe for like a decade. So we don't mean to terrify you, but I really just want to reiterate what Carl said. No deal is, you know, is better than a bad deal because we want you to be able to make music forever. That's for sure. So and what we're going to talk about positive things soon, I promise. But you're also chief operating officer and partner at Eagle, where you are disrupting hip hop, tech, and venture. So tell us about Eagle. Tell us about this entity.
Yeah, Eagle's a really cool company that I co-founded with an incredible artist named Blast, who is who's had an incredible run right now in hip hop and R&B. And then his manager, Vic. So the three of us kind of co-founded this company, Eagle, with the intent to disrupt in the music industry. But a lot of it was cashing in on that cultural currency. I think the beauty of working in the music industry and having access to artists, talent, those sorts of relationships is, one, generally speaking, people outside of the industry view you as a tastemaker, or at least view or think you're cool in some way or know somebody really cool. So, you know, you're sort of able to leverage that to do a lot of stuff outside the industry. I think, you know, music is just one vehicle in a person's journey to impact, right? So eventually, I think music should be a vehicle that gets you to other forms of impact, whether it be, you know, building a tech company that makes the world a better place, or doing a lot of foundation or community work. And so Eagle, we're doing a lot of cool music. You know, obviously at Blast, we have a few other artists, but we also have a partnership with Warner Chappell that we sign songwriters and producers to, and we partner and we do a lot of cool stuff. And it's not just music. It's, you know, we take a lot of the music money and invest it in tech companies, and we're also doing a lot of community work. And, you know, I think sometimes the music industry makes you feel like music is everything, and music just another vehicle to impact.
That is so true. And Warner Chappell is a major publishing company. And so Is Eagle all like a business built around Blast? Like, is Blast involved in bringing in other artists? Or, 'cause to me, it sounds like you've built a business around the artists, which I freaking love.
Yeah, I think the idea of building an artist company is what happened. But I think Eagle's a little different. I think we have another artist signed, and then we have songwriters and producers signed. And we have a growing merch business that's separate from Blast. So the idea was for him to have his own entity. But, you know, some of the greatest and biggest companies in the world aren't associated with one person. So I think eventually you want to use your personal influence to create an entity that isn't so much so tied into your fate. Like, who wants to be, you know, performing till they're 70 years old or have the obligation to, maybe if that's what you want to do, that's fine. But, you know, the goal is to build bigger companies inside the music space that artists own, right? And the stakeholders that help them build it, they own some too. And I think that's sort of the blueprint that we're trying to lay and show that, like, you know, artist companies are more traditional business than people think. And, you know, you should staff them properly. You should have, you know, proper corporate governance, and you should try to expand into different arenas and areas, just like any other company would.
Would you say Roc Nation is a good example of that?
Great example of that. And I think that's another great example of some building something that is bigger than you, right? It's like, you know, Jay would have just called his company Jay-Z Inc. You know, sure, it would have been cool, but, you know, Roc exists separately from, you know, and it's just one of many ventures. And I think at Eagle and Blast in general, you know, without speaking for him, I think we're not the traditional, I'm an artist, you know, it's all about creativity. I think this art is just, again, a vehicle to get to the next level of impact.
I love that. So you have your firm, the Folks Firm, your partner at Firm Sports. We just talked about Eagle. How do you balance these three incredible companies and roles? Because that's a lot.
Yeah, I ask myself that every day. and it's definitely time is a finite resource. And, you know, I think time management is a skill that you constantly have to work on. Some of the most successful people in the world probably haven't mastered time management the way that they want to. So time management is something that you work on every single day. But I can tell you it starts with a lot of the basics, you know, organization, waking up a little bit earlier, you know, protecting your time, right? If there's a meeting on your calendar and it doesn't make sense, you know, knock it off. Scrutinizing your life to make it more efficient is something that I try to do.
It's so true. I mean, people always say, you know, to me, and I'm sure to Carl, like, oh, you work in music and entertainment. That must be so exciting. But you're exactly right. It's a lot of time management. So that's a really crucial skill. Okay, so now we're going to get into what I call the vegetarian meat of this episode. Get your business affairs together. I'm going to say up front, and Carl can feel free to back me up on this or not, none of this is legal advice. If you enter into any sort of label, publishing, producer, or management deal, make sure you've retained your own music attorney to represent you. I feel very strongly about that. I've had clients, you know, that I didn't know very well at first want to work with a family friend or a real estate attorney. And that's just like, I could do a whole podcast episode on why that's not a good idea. But there are also legal elements that you actually don't need an attorney for. So that's what I want to dig into a little bit today. Would you agree or disagree with anything I just said? Because you're actually an attorney.
No, I agree. I agree deeply.
Cool. Okay. So first, how should songwriting splits be discussed, determined, and solidified? And what is a songwriting split? Maybe we should define that.
Obviously a songwriting split, you're talking about the underlying composition in the pub side. So how is that publishing going to get distributed and divvied out? That's a great question. I think, you know, it's very genre specific. You know, I think each genre kind of distributes publishing a little bit differently. I know in hip hop and R&B, we kind of view this, you know, the 100% bucket as 50% goes to the composers, so like the producers or the instrumentalists, and 50% goes to the actual words of the song, the lyrics. And it gets based and it gets broken down based on that. So if you wrote all of the lyrics, you would get 50%. And if you also produce the beat, then you get 100%. But we kind of base it on that. But I know other industries where a lot of what we would call, you know, co-producers, you know, in rock or country, they might just say, hey, you're not a co-producer. You're like a work for hire instrumentalist. Like you just played a little instrument and we're not going to give you any publishing. We're just going to pay you out. So a lot of times it's industry specific. And I think it's very important to get context for your genre in particular.
I love that. And I also want to highlight how I said, how should songwriting splits be discussed? You have to discuss them. You have to talk about this, you know, because I've seen, you know, not people I've worked with, but heard so many times of, you know, this is good life advice, but like people making assumptions, right? That they wrote on something and then something is released and 6 months later, it breeds resentment. People are upset. So I always say, before you go into the studio, get coffee, you know, with your players, your producer, your mom, anyone that's going to set foot into the studio. And if you wrote those songs, and I'm speaking a little bit from like the indie rock end, just for example, but like, if you wrote those songs, let people know that, but then say, if you feel you contribute to the songwriting process at any point, you have to tell me immediately after the session. So that way there's a clear channel of communication and people aren't just like making assumptions and getting upset. So, you know, would you agree that it's just important to have a process to discuss this so everyone's on the same page?
Sure. But I would say the way that music is made now, a lot of it's through the internet, sending loops and sounds back and forth, which I think makes the business even a bit easier to talk about, right? Because before you accept somebody's sound, you could say, hey, so, you know, what's your terms usually for a guitar loop or this, you know, vocal sample you sent over? What's your terms? That's easy. That's fairly okay. I know what I'm getting if I use this. When you're actually in the studio, especially with unsophisticated, and I'm not calling them unsophisticated because, you know, they're dumb. I mean, unsophisticated because they don't have any, you know, experience in the industry. When you're dealing with unsophisticated sort of other, you know, co-writers or co-producers, you definitely want to have that conversation. If you're doing it in studio, you definitely want to have that conversation about, hey, here's what you can expect, or this is what I have, this amount of publishing available for, you know, for what I want you to contribute. It's very important that you have like an actual understanding and going into a song as much as you possibly can, right? Because I know the creative process is can be loopy and it can be very informal. But, you know, if you are collaborating with a songwriter, okay, like, hey, if we're going to make the song today, we'll just split the writer side 50-50 today. Even if it's a little bit unfair, right? Like, even if, you know, you might have wrote a little bit more than that person, sometimes it's just easier to break it down that way. So you gotta have those tough conversations. But I would say the way a lot of music is made today, it actually leaves a lot of room for you know, co-writers and co-producers to do that stuff via text, you know, email, and kind of establish terms before you even use the sound.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was going to bring that up too. That's kind of like old school country Nashville, but you're exactly right. Like, you know, sometimes co-writers might go into a co-writing session and agree before they even, you know, walk in the door, like, okay, we're just going to split this 50-50. You know, that's easy. I've been fortunate to work with a lot of big songwriters that could command a higher songwriting split based on their name, and they don't, you know, they say, oh, I wrote 5% of that, or, oh, I wrote 80% of that, you know, so we've given you a few options here. And after you have that, oh, and I also want to reiterate what you just said about sometimes it can be easier, you know, with email and text. That's something Zoe Keating said on season one, that can kind of take the emotion out of it a little bit. So if you're feeling awkward or you're feeling hesitant about having these conversations, communicating via email, you know, gives you a moment to breathe. But once you do agree to these splits, whether it's verbally or however, how do you recommend people really memorialize those songwriting splits so everybody has that down, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot easier to do if you have management or legal in place, you know, because then, you know, maybe you just, you know, have your manager send out an email or a split sheet. But if you don't have that, I mean, you know, I think there are templates online that are simple split sheet, you know, one pagers that are available that, you know, obviously you want to be catered to each scenario, but if it's not, it'll do the job for now, right? Like, I think sometimes you just want to know, hey, I'm getting 50%, they're getting 50%, right? Yeah. And so those split sheets can be helpful. Even if it's a little bit, you know, less formal than a split sheet, any memorialization or any record. So if I send an email saying, please confirm these terms, just write confirmed, right? And, you know, you kind of have an agreement right there. So you just want that on chain or some sort of record of it that when things do get sticky, you know, you have something that you can sort of cite or, you know, that you can go back toward.
That's really important and powerful what Carl just said. So again, the like old school pre-digital way would be a split sheet. You know, Carl and I write a song together. We agree to 50-50. We sign our names. But I really encourage you to have these conversations and then agree to the terms over email. And then like Carl said, say, you know, please confirm what we discussed today. Make sure you get a confirmation on that. And I would also say do that over email more than text because you don't want to lose something to iCloud or it's stuck, you know, on an old phone or something like that. So then you have it in writing and everyone's on the same page. So I am super excited about this next question as a professor in particular, but also someone that talks to artists all the time. Where can people get beats online that they can use for sync? Does that might not
beats
exist
online that they can use for sync?
That may not exist, so but maybe if you could.
You mean
yeah? Go ahead.
Like somebody wants to pitch to like Netflix or.
So what I'm talking about?
What do you mean? Like yeah. Someone who writes a song and wants to like BeatStars, for example, or yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm talking about is when a student comes to me with their music and says, I got these beats online and it says I can distribute it to Spotify or it says this or it says that. I'm like, okay, I guess I believe that. But then to me, the main issue is if someone wants to license that song, that just seems like a legal nightmare and impossible for sync. So I guess what I'm trying to ask, is there a place where musicians can go and get beats online and actually really use them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a very 2023 question. I'll say that just because that's just, you know, very realistic. That's just something that happens all the time. You know, obviously BeatStars is available and, you know, you go to BeatStars website, there's tiers, right? You can buy like an exclusive license, so it's just yours, or you can buy like a partial license. And, you know, in those terms, there should be a sort of description about what you can actually do with that song. Now, it doesn't mean that people are always going to enforce it all the way, all the time. But you just want to be on the safer side. So BeatStars is a pretty cool platform where you can, like, purchase beats. You can either get the exclusive rights or
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
For set price, or you can kind of buy like a non-exclusive license or a smaller license that's a bit more catered to what you need. But that exclusive license is usually what you'll want if you want to pitch it for sync and put it up on Spotify and DSPs.
Thank you. You have no idea how helpful that is. What I usually say is, or create your own beats, but I know that's easier said than done.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea. And I think it's getting easier and easier to any producers out there, you know, listen to this. This is not a knock, but this is the easiest time it's been to learn how to make a beat or make music. And then, you know, AI kind of coming into the picture. Maybe guys like me can even start producing. You know?
Yeah. Are you more of a musician or athlete or both?
Definitely athlete. Cool. I play basketball pretty competitively. So I'm not a musician at all.
Well, fantastic. And I was actually going to ask if you had a background in sports, because I think that really helps to hone time management skills. So that makes a lot of sense with what you were saying before.
Yep.
Love it. So what is a work for hire agreement? And why does everyone who sets foot in a studio need to sign one? In my opinion, don't mean to force that second half on you.
Yeah, a work for hire just means you were brought in specifically to as work, right? You're a hired person and you're not being separately, your contributions aren't viewed separately. So by bringing in somebody to specifically, you know, add some horns to a song, that might be a work for hire situation. Now as work for hire, you won't have the same claim to publishing or right to copyright. The thing about work for hire that's really, really, really significant is there are no termination rights, right? You can't come back and say, hey, 35, 45 years from now, that was a work for hire, but, you know, it expired, so it's mine again. You know, when you assign copyright, like a copyright assignment, there's what we call a right to termination. So you might have given your rights away to a copyright, but in 35 years, you might be able to get that copyright back. But in a work for hire, there is no, termination right. And that's really significant.
That is such a good point. I had not considered that. And, you know, again, what we're talking about here, I might be dating myself with this reference and I don't care, you know, like Lauryn Hill's famous album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, that won like a million Grammys and is so iconic. A lot of people came, this happens all the time. A lot of people came out of the woodwork after that was successful and said, oh, I wrote on that. Oh, I played on that. So we want to make sure that, you know, like you said, if you're hiring outside players and you wrote the music, and you own the recording, that, it's clear, like, hey, I'm paying you this amount. And like I said, it goes back to communication, like we were talking about before. If that horn player writes a whole new part, you know, in my opinion, be upfront about that. Like, hey, if you feel like you write on something, let me know so we can figure out your publishing. But again, you don't want someone coming. This is why, like, you know, you can't enter Beyonce's studio without signing a work for hire, or really any major artist, right? Because no one wants to deal with someone saying, I wrote that word or I wrote that lyric. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that will dictate a lot of it. You know, I think there's what me and Emily are talking about, which are some of the principles and the things that you should probably follow. Then there's also the common sense element where sometimes you just need to get in a room and you need to get an opportunity, and you're not always going to be able to negotiate. And that's just a sad reality of it. You know, I have some clients who've done some work for really, really big artists. And if that same contribution was with a smaller artist, they would have got a much larger chunk of publishing and, you know, a higher royalty split. But, you know, you pick your battles. And, I think that's like an unsung part of all of this, right? You want to have your ducks in order. But the reality is, there's always a business decision, at the end of every single decision you make.
And do you have any, I mean, they could hire you. Do you have any recommendations on where people can get a work for hire agreement?
Yeah, you definitely hire an attorney. But that's also another agreement that's commonly found on the internet. And, I don't necessarily recommend solely relying on internet-based templates, but again, that's one of those agreements that that's pretty standard and easy.
I totally agree. And there's a great company, I should learn how to pronounce their name, but it's Cosigned. Cosynd,
Cosynd.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you can get work for hires there for like $40 or $50, and they're a music specific company. Or you didn't hear it from me, or Carl kind of implied this, but there's probably free work for hires floating around online. So that's a pretty standard group. But go with Cosynd. They're women owned, and they're great attorneys. So here's a broad question. How are producers paid?
That's a very good question. Producers are usually paid in three ways. You usually get your percent of publishing, which you'd collect, right? That's no one else's job but yours to collect. Your publisher or ASCAP, BMI, all of those things combined. That's your publishing's part. Then there's the master royalty, or what is known as a producer point. So that's a piece of income that should be coming from the major label or the record label. And if it's not a record label, it might be an indie distributor. The artist might put the song up, be a DistroKid, and you should be a certain percentage of gross receipts or net receipts, depending on what you negotiate, should be coming to you directly from the distributor. So that those are what you call the producer points. And then there should be some sort of fee in advance. Advance usually recoupable. Sometimes you can get a non-recoupable, and the recoupment ties to the master side, not the publishing. There's no recoupment on the pub side. That is something you just collect. The recoupment's tied to that master royalty or a producer point. So you take a higher advance, it's going to take you a little bit longer to get paid out on the master royalty. So that's maybe something to consider. I would say this as a rule of thumb, if you're dealing with major labels, this is not a knock to major labels as a whole, but the accounting systems are shoddy. I don't care what anyone has to say. I don't trust them. I don't even understand how they're calculating recoupment, nor do I think they're dedicating the time, energy, manpower, or technology to accurately disseminate accounting statements. So I try to get as much money up front on the master side, like a bigger advance if I'm dealing with a major label. But, if you're dealing with an artist who's distributing directly via DistroKid or United Masters or something like that, a higher royalty in lieu of an advance might be something that makes sense because you're going to see those royalties.
So let's say an artist is not on a major label, because most aren't. And say an artist runs a Kickstarter or something, or they have the money to pay the producer's fee. So that's out of the way. What kind of, talk about the producer points a little bit. Talk about the royalty on the recording side. And not to jump around too much, what does that look like if a producer is with a label or not? What are some standards and numbers there?
I mean, that is an amazing point that I think even music industry people struggle with. Because producer points, when you think about PPD the ancient royalty terms, they are really meant for record labels in the archaic record label system. So three producer points is usually 3 points. So if an artist is signed to an 18% royalty deal, meaning they're getting 18 out of the 100% pie, 3% producer points would mean that the artist is now getting 15% and not instead of the full 18%. So a point is just one royalty percentage. Now, that doesn't exactly translate maybe to the way independent artists kind of put out their music. But generally speaking, a rule of thumb would be, say the average common producer points for a major label artist is 3 out of 18, 3%, producer points. Whatever that number is, whatever that that percentage comes out to be, you try to apply that on the net receipts or the gross receipts side. So you'd use something more along with, hey, after marketing costs, or after the song cost of production are paid for, I'll give you 15%, instead of viewing it as a point. There are no producer points when you're distributing directly via DistroKid or any distributor. You're talking about gross receipts now. You're talking about a percentage of my 100% pot, right? Because you're usually talking about 100% pot there. How much of that 100% is going to that producer? And I think if we're using the same old school 3 out of 18, you could do that math to figure out what percentage that is, and you can direct that amount via the 100% pot.
Yeah. And I would say, and obviously feel free to disagree, that's going to slide based on if you can, because thinking about an independent artist, that producer royalty on the recording side is going to slide a little bit depending on if you have the cash or not, right?
That's spot on. You know, I rep a lot of producers and I kind of got my start being a producer advocate. So, you know, if the artist didn't have the advance or fee, you know, I will always say, hey, then we need half the master. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. But you have a lot more of a stake to demand more if they can't afford your full budget.
And I actually think that's really cool. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say there's some alternatives too. I think we've also been creative. You might say, hey, I want a feature credit. I want those streams to show up on my DSP profile. I want to swap instead of, I want to start putting out some music and I want a verse from you and instead of, you know, a fee or whatever. So there's creative ways for you to get your value back in return that might make more sense for you.
And I love that. Like, that's something I love about the modern music industry, because in the pre-digital era, you were beholden to like, okay, that 3, 4, 5 point, you know, producer that Carl was talking about. But now you might want to work with one of Carl's producers. You might be a super talented artist. The producer's into it. Carl's into it. You don't have that cash, but I actually think it's cool, which might sound weird, but I think it's nice to have that flexibility to give up a higher percentage on the recording if you don't have thousands of dollars to pay the producer. So I think that's very empowering. I want to give you one other scenario. Say an independent artist, and obviously these are all hypotheticals, but say an independent artist gets the cash together for a producer, you know, is giving the producer points that's asked for, maybe 15% or whatever on an independent release. But what if the producer, and again, you did say before this can be genre specific, what if the producer doesn't write on anything? They're literally just producing the recording. Do you still feel they should be owed publishing? Obviously, it's going to depend on who you're representing, but does that make sense?
You mean only just like a beat contribution, like instrumental?
Yeah, like, exactly.
I made the beat.
Yes. Although that's a whole podcast. I'm sorry to interrupt. That's a podcast episode in itself, right? Like, is making a beat songwriting or producing, but go ahead.
Yeah. And I would say in modern times, you know, all, if you're getting a piece of publishing, you're kind of viewed as a songwriter, right? At the end of the day. I mean, you know, cause you know, in the publisher space, you're either the songwriter or the publisher, right? So if you have any sort of publishing, you kind of are viewed as a songwriter. So I think that word's a bit archaic in the modern age, especially when you think about the way music's made. You know, sometimes people, when they're picking up the music industry, is trying to learn it. Sometimes they think the word songwriter is an exclusionary term, so it doesn't include producer. And in my vantage point, that's just not true. You know, you're a composer, right? Like, you're not Mozart. You may not be playing an instrument, but you're composing the music. Which in turn makes you a songwriter because, you know, you are creating melodies that are musical notes. That's very technical, obviously. I don't want to get there. So if you are a producer in hip hop and R&B, you will get your cut of publishing. That is the most standard thing ever. And you will get talked out of that time and time and try to get talked out again. But that is the baseline standard in hip hop and R&B. If you produce the beat, you are going to get 50% of that song on the publishing side. So it could be a very lucrative career if you are getting big placements in hip hop and R&B.
Do you feel that way if it's a brand new producer and a bigger artist?
That's a very practical question. I would say as a rule of thumb, I would say, yeah. I mean, you got to think about the way producers and songwriters eat, you know, artists get to tour the song. They get the mass, and for context, people, you know, when a song is streamed on Spotify, 57% of that, and these are rough numbers, but around 57% of the money generated from Spotify goes to the master holder. 30% stays with Spotify or Apple Music, and around 10 to 13% gets paid out to publishers. So, you know, if your song's not on radio, which is a very big publishing bucket, or is not getting synced, and you're relying on streaming money, That's the only thing you're getting. You're only already only getting 13%. You know, part of it is about understanding the ecosystem and how people have to eat. And I think, you know, if that's the compromise of having and incentivizing more songwriting and producing and have then giving away 50% of something that's already undervalued in the ecosystem, I don't have a problem with that at all. And so I don't think it's a measure of whether the artist is big or not. I think that's a general practice. If I was, you know, again, you know, thinking about collective bargaining and unionizing, creating some standards, you know, that's one of those things that I would sort of, I would sort of really hammer to rock and make you know, legislate.
That's why you're a good attorney. I'm going to give you one last scenario. Say I am purely a songwriter and I don't tour, right? I mean, this who I'm about to use as an example is a huge songwriter, but like Diane Warren or someone, right? There's plenty of people that are just songwriters. So I don't know. Like, how do you feel about that? Because if someone's representing the songwriter or if I'm the songwriter and, you know, the producer's like, well, I get 50% of that. I feel like the songwriter could use the same argument if they are just a songwriter, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it's an appreciation for both sides, right? You know, you make a song and, you know, a lot of it, again, I'll lean in on hip hop and R&B. It's like a lot of the essence of that song comes from the beat and the melody. Mm-hmm. Production is hip hop.
Yeah.
It's, you know, hip hop started with production, not lyrics calling, you know, the DJs and the producers, they were the superstars. Then it sort of developed into something else. But it's such a core element of music that both should have mutual appreciation for each other. That's why we kind of have that 50%, you know, sort of buckets to pull from. Now, what I will say is no one's stopping that songwriter from charging a songwriting fee, which would be new precedent in a lot of industries. And the greats get to do that, but maybe that's the compromise, not stealing money from producers, but taking more money from the people who have it in the industry.
Yeah. And that's true entrepreneurship right there. And that's kind of what I was saying at the beginning of this episode. Like, we have a lot of liberty and license and creativity in music. So figure out what makes sense. You know, we want to work together and we want to grow together as a community. So thank you for bearing with me on that. Well, you know, one last thing on producers, and, you know, this is similar to what we were talking about with songwriting splits, but what if an artist and producer are working together, and which I'm sure happens here in Milwaukee all the time, it happens everywhere, right? And can't afford an attorney. How can they memorialize their terms?
Stick to the basics. Don't try to be an attorney, right? Yeah. If you're trying to memorialize your song splits, send an email saying, hey, these are the publishing splits for this song. Please confirm, and this shall, you know, serve as an agreement, right? Or, you know, these terms shall be agreed to in a record. Don't try to be an attorney. You're not. Just keep it simple. You know, the common sense is something that should be in the spirit of everything you do, whether it's like law. So just keep it simple. You know, the goal of memorializing it is to create that chain of record that you can prove. You know, you think about even blockchain and the why people were excited about it, at least from like that side, is that it created a chain of record that couldn't be edited or changed. You know, it was memorialized, right? And if you have an email sent from an account, you know, you're just creating that chain of record for yourself. So my goal, my advice is don't try to be an attorney. You know, try to just get the job done.
I love that. So wise, because I hear from artists all the time, like, oh, I found this producer agreement on the internet, and they send some like 10-page agreement that, you know, they or any attorney can't understand. So you heard it from Carl. Keep it simple. We already kind of touched on this, but are there options, because it's not just producers, right? Are there options to compensate players, of course, producers and engineers, if you truly do not have cash to do so? So say people in this room want to work together. Yeah, go ahead.
Always publishing or royalties, yep. You know, if you can't pay somebody, then that's when you really have to say, hey, here's a royalty, here's a piece of publishing. the spirit of fairness, man. You know, I think that's just how you have to operate in this business. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you don't have the money to afford or pay an instrumentalist, that might mean, hey, I'll give you 10% of publishing or 5% of publishing. Yeah. And that's the trade-off. You have to, it's bootstrapping, bartering. It's the core of like all business. Like there's no one size fits all shoe.
And again, to me, that's very empowering because that's not something that could happen in the pre-digital era. Okay. So I know this could have a million answers too, but how should a remix deal be structured or what are some options there?
A remix deal is a lot simpler, I think, and it should be framed in a way, the core of a song's already there, right? And most remixes are using the chords and the lyrics that already exist. So oftentimes, you know, there's less royalties involved and it's a small royalty and more likely a fee, that like a remix fee. But there'll be smaller royalties there. But understanding why they're smaller is important because the fabric of the song was already created, right? You're just remixing the fabric of that song. So oftentimes that looks like a fee with a really, really small royalty.
Yeah. And like anything, this is all negotiable, right? So if it's some huge artist that's going to remix you and they want a higher royalty, I would say go for it.
Yep.
So how are arrangers paid?
Engineers, is that sort of the equivalent?
No, like if someone wants to do it, if you want a new arrangement of your song.
Yep, it's interesting. I always give context. My experience, 95% has existed in, my music experience has existed in hip hop and R&B. The concept of arranging is usually done by either the producer or the artist themselves. Mm-hmm. So it is not a common, you know, arrange, like what are we charging here? I actually probably shouldn't and couldn't speak on arranging compensation.
That's okay. I can offer some, I can shed some light on that. So arranging is not songwriting. It's usually a fee. And so like what we're talking, and I don't know the terms behind this, but for example, like, you know, Dolly Parton's version of her song, I Will Always Love You, is very different from Whitney Houston's version of I Will Always Love You, right? So I just remember it drilled into my brain in music school. Arranging is not songwriting, so that's usually fee-based, but like we talked about, you could get creative there as well. So what does an artist need to do if they're releasing a cover song?
Yeah, cover songs are, you know, purely a publishing thing, right? You know, in terms of actually, you know, important to understand why, you know, you're not getting any publishing on a cover. You're not changing the lyrics and you're not creating the melody. So, you know, those are underlying composition items. So you have to give up your publishing, obviously, because you didn't write or produce the song. You know, you will be able to eat on the master without, you know, compromise, without sort of having to pay like a sample fee or anything like that, or cut them in. That is purely, usually that's a publishing conversation. Samples are different. So you better make sure that if you're covering a song, you're covering it and not creating a new version.
Yeah. And that goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the episode, the two rights, right? So when you're covering a song, the songwriter needs to be compensated. So you can head over to Harry Fox's website and you can purchase a mechanical license and they will help you to estimate the number of streams and so how much you owe to pay for that mechanical license. Generally speaking, you can cover any song that you want when you're playing live. You all know sometimes there's venues that aren't paying their performing rights organizations, you know, in the US, ASCAP, BMI, CSAC and GMR fees. But that's very rare. Most venues pay their PRO fees, so you're good to go to play covers live, which is different from releasing a cover. And Carl brings up a really good point. A sample is going to be on the recording side. So that's a perfect segue into my next question. How do samples get cleared and what does that even mean?
Yeah, in regards to sample clearance, it's a two-part process. You got to deal with whoever owns the master and you got to deal with the songwriters and publishers. So those are parties that you have to get clearance from. It's a two-sided clearance.
That's great. Well, Carl, thank you so much for your time. We deeply appreciate it. And I'm going to stick around to answer a few more questions on business affairs.
Thank you. This was awesome. Thank you, Emily. And the book is great. And, I was glad to be here today.
Thank you. We'll be in touch. Have a great night. Yay! Okay. So I had two more questions for Carl, and then I want to open it up to you guys and be a wannabe attorney. So I also wanted to talk about what's recommended for a group band agreement. So while we're talking about business affairs, if you are in a group or a band, now is the time to have this conversation, right? Like, you're getting ready to record, you're putting your band and group together, so you don't want to talk about this 6 months down the line, a year down the line, just like songwriting. So I come from like more the indie rock side of things. So again, like in indie rock, you're generally going to talk about the songwriting splits, and they are truly going to be the songwriting splits. So like I said, I've been privileged to work with, you know, songwriters in Wilco and in the Raconteurs. And if they write 10%, that's what they ask for. That's just been my experience. At the same time, there's, you know, huge pop stars that don't write on anything that can command 50% of songwriting or publishing, right? And I totally get that, right? Because if you're recording with a huge pop star, they're probably going to turn it into a huge hit. So I'm dating myself with these references, but Janet Jackson, Britney Spears, Madonna, whatever, right? Although many of those people are songwriters, so I don't want to take anything away from that. But you get the idea. There are pop stars that command songwriting cuts on songs that they didn't write. So that's a conversation to have with your band and group, right? Like, how are we going to handle songwriting? Are they really going to be the splits? Are we going to do it Lennon-McCartney style and just split it 50-50? Are we going to split everything five ways? These are really important conversations to have. And it's kind of like a prenup. You want to have this conversation when you're in love, right? Not when, God forbid, you're getting divorced and the relationship is ending. So figure it out. Try to think about the long term. Try to think about, God forbid, you know, you're not playing with these people. You're not working with these folks anymore. And it doesn't always have to be a divorce, right? Like, you're working with human beings. So someone could decide to go to school. They could decide, you know, touring's not for them. They're staying home and starting a family, like whatever, right? So figure out how you're going to handle songwriting and how you're going to handle those conversations. And again, not to keep saying this, but in my background, that tends to be the songwriting splits are the songwriting splits are the true songwriting splits. But then there's everything else, right? There's recording, which we talked about in depth today. There's merchandising. There's branding deals. You know, especially when you're starting out and when you're independent, there might be someone in the band or group who's fronting some of these costs, right? So maybe paying for gas for touring, or we'll talk about different merch options and on-demand merch options so you don't have to do this, but there's pros and cons of doing it. But if someone's pressing up merch, right? If someone's pressing up shirts or vinyl or whatever, that person should get paid back, obviously, for their expenses. And then generally in a band or group, in my experience, everything but songwriting is divided equally, right? So you get paid, I keep saying $1,000, but $1,000 for a show, or you make $1,000 in merch online or in person or whatever, you're going to split that income after the person who's fronted gas and whatever it took to get there or make the items are reimbursed. So again, like, now is the time to have these conversations instead of waiting. And then what should folks look for and look out for in management contracts? So I've run management companies for decades. And, you know, traditional management contracts will sign you up for a term, for like a length of time. I personally don't love that. You might not be able to get out of that or get around that. And I understand that, because the manager is investing time, you know, and resources into you. But traditionally, a management contract is going to be like 3 years or 5 years. I was, or however many years. I don't think it should be too many more years than 3 or 5. That's for sure. And again, I do get that a little bit on the management side because it's a really hard job. There was a study at one point that I think, like, with all the promo work and all the things, you know, all the work that goes in that doesn't directly bring in revenue, which I know you all can relate to. I mean, being a manager and sometimes being an artist can be less than minimum wage, right? So I understand where when a manager is, you know, working for a few years to work with an artist and build them up, that they might want them to stick around a few more years instead of maybe, you know, hopping to another manager. How we've always structured our deals, I think this is something I made up. Maybe this exists other places. Because what's also in a management agreement is what's called post-term, okay? So the old school way would be, you know, I'm managing you, and if we split up, I get a percentage on everything I worked on, again, in perpetuity, forever, right? I wasn't comfortable with any of these things. I wasn't comfortable with the term thing because I felt like if someone didn't want to work with me, I didn't want them like counting down the days until they didn't have to work with me. I wanted, you know, want them to be able to terminate that relationship. And then I was really uncomfortable with the perpetuity element in post-term for management agreements. So I came up with what my attorney calls, my great attorney, Joyce Dollinger, calls a mirrored term. And frankly, every artist we've ever worked with really liked this. And so what that means is if I work with Oscar for a year, then I get a year of post-term on what I worked with Oscar on. So I wouldn't get anything in the future when Oscar goes on to make more music, but I would get a year of post-term on recordings and publishings that Oscar worked on under the term. If I worked with Eli for 3 years, I would get 3 years of post-term. If I worked with Alex for, I mean, hopefully, you know, God forbid there's never a split and we work together forever. But that's always how we set up our management agreements. And also we set it up, and this is standard too, where the post-term would diminish. So maybe I'm just making this up, but maybe we would get 15%, which is a standard manager cut. 15% of the gross for a year, maybe, you know, in year 2 and 3, we would get 10%. And then maybe in year 4 and 5, we would get 5%. So it would be a diminishing term on that. Yeah, but otherwise, I mean, we'll talk more about this in the final episode when we talk more about traditional artist teams. Ask the manager's other artists what it's like to work with them. And also be upfront with the manager. Like, will you be my main point of contact? Will there be a day-to-day manager? There's no right or wrong answer on that. I, you know, came up managing, I keep talking about the Dresden Dolls, but I came up managing the Dresden Dolls, and they took on management when I graduated college, and I was the band's day-to-day manager. And I'm forever grateful that they went with a really forward-thinking person named Mike Luba, because Luba was smart enough, frankly, to not be threatened by me, who was like a core part of the band's team. And I really like managed the band. And then when I needed something, he was there. And that's really smart from his perspective as a partner at a great management company, Madison House, because it allowed him to take on more artists, right? So when you have, so you might want a really good day-to-day manager that's hustling for you and grinding for you. And then, you know, it's great to have Luba and his wisdom and experiences as I was still learning and growing in my industry career. So yeah, I think those are the main, you know, those are my thoughts on management agreements. And yeah, so I'd like to open it up to you guys on any business affairs questions, issues, anything we covered you don't understand, anything that's going on with you guys.
Yes, Oscar. And you can stay seated.
Hi, everyone. My name is Oscar, for those at home. And this is a very straightforward question, but something I'm sure a lot of young artists have on their minds. I was wondering, at what point in time, at what point in an artist's growth and thought process should they start to look for an attorney, and what qualities should they look for in said attorney?
Yeah. Really great question. This is why the final episode and the final chapter of my book is called When Do I Need an Attorney, Business Manager, and Manager Defining an Artist's Traditional Team? The reason I use the word attorney at the beginning of that title is I often see artists with attorneys who don't need attorneys, right? So remember that attorneys in the music industry can get paid two ways. Generally, it's cash, right? It's going to be like a $1,500, $2,000, $2,500 retainer. And then their fees can range anything, you know, anywhere from like $300 for a brand new attorney up to like $750 an hour plus, right? So a lot of times I've met artists at conferences and they're like, this is my attorney. And I'm thinking, you're paying them to be there, right? So to answer your question, you only really need, I mean, it's great to have someone advocating for you. And like I mentioned my attorney, Joyce, she's like my proverbial big sister. There's amazing attorneys and humans like Carl and Joyce out there. But to answer your question, you only, in my opinion, need a music attorney if you are doing a label deal, a publishing deal, a management contract, a producer contract, really anything dealing with your rights. Otherwise, you don't really need an attorney. Again, we'll get more into this in the final episode, but managers, and maybe I'm biased, work on commission, right? So we only make money when you do. I mean, there's consulting deals and there's different ways to pay managers for sure. But just keep that in mind. Now, if an attorney does want to take you on for 5% and they're really passionate about you, I would say go for it. If that's your first team member, great. But there's no reason in this day and age that you need to be shelling out thousands of dollars for an attorney until you need one. And the reason I say in this day and age is in the pre-digital era, you needed an attorney to shop your recordings to labels because, and this is the case still very often, major labels won't accept unsolicited recordings because they want to make sure it's really you, right? So it needs to come from someone they know. But this was all in the era when you needed a label to record and you needed a label to distribute. I mean, our next episode is going to be called How to Record With or Without a Budget. And then we're also going to talk about on episode 6, setting up your release and distribution plan. Those are the two main elements that have completely revolutionized the modern music industry. And I don't think we would be sitting in this room talking about this if that wasn't the case. So again, the short answer is, in my opinion, you don't need an attorney unless you are doing a major rights deal, which would be label, publishing, producer, or management. Yeah, Eli.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm Eli. I have a pretty loaded question, and I'm kind of gonna just like rant for a little bit before it actually
do it.
A question. But so my first thought, I guess, was how much can you get away with stealing? Because I know if you sample drums, a lot of times no one's gonna come after you for that. Obviously, a top line melody can easily be stolen and you can easily claim that someone stole it. A chord progression is kind of like sus, I guess. But I once met a songwriter who talked about how part of the obligation in his deal was that he had to like write 20 songs or something, and he couldn't get out of his contract until that happened. And he had done stuff like write the top line melodies or like write like certain parts of the song. And then the label would be like, okay, you only wrote like 18% of that song. So he would have to like write 5 more songs before he wrote like one song, you know? So if he wrote like 20% of this song, he only wrote 20% of a song, you know, like that doesn't count as a song. So then I was also wondering, is publishing and recording always 50-50? And I guess, like, I don't know, like, what parts of a song are more valuable? And I guess, I don't know, if you're working with a band, that's something you hash out on your own. But, like, yeah, I don't know. This all seems like so much gray area. So I guess that's my question.
Okay, cool. So let's break that down in a few ways. First, recording and publishing is always 50-50. I'm not an attorney, but that's, I'm going to go on a limb and say that's the law. That's just how it is. Let's break down each thing and talk about stealing. So I know you talked about top line. What else did you talk about? Songwriting and beats?
I talked about top line and then like a rhythm. Say like, I don't know. Like
yeah.
Drums and then I guess just like, yeah, like the underlying melody or like the beat, I guess.
Sure. Okay, so I'll talk about beats first. You know, I feel like the hot topic right now in the industry is AI. If you guys are seeing that and reading about that, that could maybe be a positive, not with what people are talking about, but like a positive element of AI, where AI could recognize that a beat was stolen, right? So that already happens, you know, when you distribute your music. I think it's pretty good. Actually, so I think that one's kind of covered. I know you said top line. What was the third one? Songwriting. You guys hear about this all the time, right? Like there's Robin Thicke court cases. There's Tom Petty. There's Sam Smith court cases, right? So that one always fascinates me. I mean, there's musicologists testifying in court saying it is the same melody. It isn't the same melody. I mean, there's philosophical conversations on this too, right? Like we all stand on the shoulder of giants, right? So I just think you're seeing that in the courts, right? That's just going to happen. I think, I really don't think people do it deliberately more often than not. You know, there's the famous, it's so bad that I'm spacing on this, but there's like a famous George Harrison song, right? And he had to pay the Shangri-Las. Or I could definitely talk about the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony. Now that might have been a sample issue. That had a Rolling Stones sample in it. And the Rolling Stones got a lot, if not all, of the publishing on that song, right? So I think when it comes to songwriting, you have to do the best you can. If you get sued, you get sued. Just be honest. Just be yourself, right? Like, brains work in amazing ways. We're going to remember things subliminally or not, right? So that just kind of is what it is. So I think to recap, AI can help solve beats and that technology is going to get better. So if you put a beat out there, the AI is going to recognize like, oh, Eli made this beat. Eli owns this. No, we are not going to let you distribute this to Spotify. When it comes to songwriting, do the best you can. You know, I don't think anyone here is trying to steal or trying to rip other people off. So that is what it is. And then top line, you know, I think same thing. That's going to fall in the AI camp. But back to the example of your friend, you know, having to write 18 or 20 songs to fulfill their label agreement or their publishing agreement. That's what Carl was saying at the beginning of this episode. Like, I mean, I'll say this first before I reiterate, Carl, like know what you're signing up for, right? Like if you don't want to write 18 songs for a label or you don't want to fulfill your publishing contract, then why did you sign it in the first place, you know? But if it's a really horrible deal, and because there's also, you know, historical awful situations of, and this is, again, something I love about the modern music industry, that you guys have creative control. The recording had to be acceptable to the label in the pre-digital era, right? And what does that even mean in art? I think it even had to be in contracts like commercially viable. Sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit. So it had to be acceptable. So you could make your art and the label could be like, no, that's not acceptable. Keep trying. And maybe that's, you know, part of the issue your friend got into is like they kept writing songs and it wasn't acceptable. And then that happened to Neil Young. And so he made albums, you know, in the early 80s, and I'm totally botching this, and I am a Neil Young fan, and I don't sound like it, but, you know, he made albums of just, like, noise, or just, like, you know, it sounds weird saying this, it's not right, but, like, electronic music, or not, like, what
the label deemed commercially acceptable for Neil Young albums, right? He was just trying to fulfill his contract to get out of it, and they just kept rejecting it. So that's why when I keep talking about this like pre-digital era, which might seem very, you know, like back in the day to you all, there is so much power. You guys have so much power and autonomy over your creative control, your creative output. You can write whatever you want. You can record whatever you want. You can distribute whatever you want. You know, you used to, in the pre-digital era, not even be able to record your own shows because that would be considered competing with the recording, competing with the label, right? And we'll talk about that more in the revenue stream episode. But yeah, hopefully that answers your question a little bit. Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
Hi, everyone. Name's Leonard Taylor. Everybody calls me LT. My question is, what do you think about artists who are starting an LLC as far as they, since they are the label, the brand, and the artist? So what do you think about them starting an LLC for their business?
Yeah. Thank you. Really, really good question. So first, consult an accountant. And I don't even really care if they're a music accountant. So I assume you live here in Wisconsin. Okay, so you want to consult a Wisconsin CPA because they might encourage you. And I will answer like your question broadly in a second. But you want to find an accountant where you live because they might say, you know what, starting an S-Corp is better for you in Wisconsin. I'm not saying that's the right advice. Or they might say, oh, you live in South Carolina? LLCs are way more protected there, right? So there's no right or wrong type of business entity to start. Just find a certified public accountant in your state because they're going to tell you like, oh, the laws in California really favor this. Like, frankly, every company I've ever started is an S-Corp. It's a lot easier on accounting, and that's what my accountants have always told me. None of my companies have ever been an LLC. But to answer what I think is your question, broadly speaking, starting an entity, I think you should start an entity, frankly, like when you can afford one. When you have an extra $500 to start an entity, do it. Because some of you may know, starting an entity will protect you if, God forbid, you get sued, right? So you're performing at a show, someone stage dives, someone has an overdose, any amount of things could happen that have nothing to do with you. That's going to protect you so you don't get sued personally. You don't lose your house, your car, or anything that you own personally. As artists get bigger, they actually set up multiple entities because if you get sued on the road, then your recording income is protected. Then your music publishing income is protected. Then your merch entity is protected, right? So to answer your question, I would say the time to start an entity is when you have some extra money to do so. And then consult with a CPA in the state that you live, and they're going to advise on the best kind of entity for you to set up. And then as you grow in your career, and we'll talk about business managers in episode 12, a business manager is a music business specific accountant or bookkeeper. As you grow, the business manager is going to say, you know what, it's time. Your recordings are too big. Your touring is too big. We need to set up different entities for those. I'm really fortunate to be close with Kevin Lyman, who's the founder of the Warped Tour. And, you know, Warped Tour ended a few years ago, and I know he was on the stand in court a few years ago because some kid got hurt, you know, crowd surfing, right? So no one is suing Kevin Lyman. He is protected by his entity. So yeah, it's a great idea to get an entity when you have that extra cash, but you don't need to do it from day one, if that makes sense. Otherwise, you can just be an individual. And again, I'm not an accountant, but everything's not everything. That's not the best advice. But like, remember, like, you know, your gas to come here was an expense. You're coming to a music business event. So you can still take those deductions as an individual. Anyone else?
Allison?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up to
Should I stand someplace else? Okay. To the LLC discussion.
Yeah.
I think for those musicians who might be thinking about that for themselves or for their bands, so I have my own music business and we issue, tax information, or we have to collect tax information from musicians. And, once you make, $800 from in the state of Wisconsin from a particular entity, then you have to fill out your tax forms and everything for that for that particular place. And if you are a musician that's doing that in a lot of different places, you have to do it for all those places, for those venues or wherever else you're doing event, any work really. And, if you are an LLC, you have a business number that you're putting on that paperwork as opposed to your social security number, which is a lot safer. And if you're doing a lot of that paperwork, you don't even know in some of these venues where that social security number is getting put. So it's really nice to just have that peace of mind where you're getting, you have a different identity number out there for your business as a musician as opposed to your personal information. So
that is brilliant insight. Thank you, Allison. And same for the address, right?
Same for the address. If you have a different address for yourself as a musician, like a PO box or something, or no studios, for your business as opposed to your personal address. But some people still use their personal address as their business address. That's fine too. But the social security number is a big one.
I love that because, and again, I think it feeds into what I'm saying. Like if you're getting gigs with Allison, if you're starting to fill out tax forms, then maybe you have the $500 to start your entity, right? So when you're getting to that space where it's like, oh, wow, I'm getting paid, right? Like that's probably when it's time to start saving money and start your entity.
My name is Gray Genius for everybody here and everybody at home. So I have a question. It's more about music administration.
Yeah.
So the first part of the question is, if you make the song, typically you're the one who registers the song, right? Not the other artists or anybody else and all that.
So well, what does make the song mean?
Or if you create, you own the song, sorry. Okay.
The recording or the publishing?
The publishing.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So that's the first part of the question. Yeah. You're typically the one who registers everything, correct?
Yeah. So say you and Oscar write a song together 50-50. You're going to register the songwriting for your 50% and Oscar's going to register the 50% for Oscar's 50%. So you're just in charge of your own publishing. But if you write the song 100%, you go and register it with your PRO and then your publishing administration, and we'll dig into what that means in episode 5.
So you wouldn't include them when you're registering them? Or like maybe they're just the artist name or?
That's exactly, I think you can put Oscar's name in just for clarity, because that's going to help ASCAP, but they can't pay Oscar. They can't pay your co-writer unless Oscar registers, because they don't know where the money is going to go. And it doesn't, you could be with ASCAP, Oscar can be with BMI. You don't have to be with the same PRO, but you're just responsible for your share. But don't quote me on this. I do think they will ask for the other info because they want to match that with your co-writer just to make sure everyone's on the same page.
Okay. And then my second part to that question is, I have BMI.
Yeah.
So yes, it's 50-50, but it's listed as 100 and 100.
Yes.
So when you, the songwriting part and the publishing part.
Yep.
If you agree to say 60-40 split, it should be the same at the top as the same as the bottom, like the songwriting part and the publishing part should be the same.
Okay, so I'll explain that. I think this is what you're asking. And again, we'll do a deeper dive on episode 5, Music Publishing Isn't Scary or Confusing, plus how to land a sync placement. But this is the business affairs episode, so it's totally appropriate. So when you write a song, you have first, like if you're a songwriter, please go sign up for a performing rights organization. In the US, that's going to be ASCAP or BMI. There's also CSAC and GMR. I push ASCAP and BMI because anyone can sign up. GMR and CSAC are invite only. I've also heard of artists being invited to CSAC and then a few years later, CSAC dropping them and switching PRO administrators is a huge pain. So just go with ASCAP or BMI. I have some more detail on the book on like, I'll just tell you, like, you know, if you know a human at one of them, maybe go with ASCAP or BMI, but it doesn't matter. These are regulated by the government. Don't overthink it. Again, there's some tips in the book from Zoe Keating and in that free podcast episode in season 1 about that. But anyway, sign up for your PRO. This is nothing to be scared of. I have met too many songwriters over the past few years, usually young, who aren't signed up for their performing rights organization. And it's different in different countries, right? So if you're in Ghana, you have, you know, that performing rights organization. If you're in the UK, it's called PRS. If you're in France, it's called CISM. But in the US, it's ASCAP and BMI. If you don't sign up for a PRO and register your songs within 2.5 years, you do not get that money. It goes into what is called the black box. It goes to Taylor Swift. It pays ASCAP's rent. So again, this is regulated by the government. That money is yours. Go get it. There is nothing scary about that. If you just sign up for a PRO and you are not collecting on your music publishing, and music publishing is songwriting, and we'll give a more clear definition on that in episode 5, you are not collecting on your music publishing in full. And this goes to what I think you're asking. So say there actually are songwriters named Emily White, but say I'm Emily White, a songwriter, and I go to register my song with ASCAP. It's going to divide me into two, even though I wrote 100% of the song. It's going to say you're Emily White, the songwriter, and then it's going to encourage me to create what's called a publishing designee. So maybe I'm Emily White Music or something too. So even though I wrote 100% of the song in the PRO in ASCAP or BMI, you're going to see that a song you wrote 100% is 50% the writer's share, 50% the publisher's share. This is an old school 20th century thing that's going to take way too long to untangle. It just is what it is. So that is why Siri said, Siri didn't get that. So that is why you need to sign up with someone like Songtrust, who's a publishing administrator, because if your songwriting is being covered, sold, streamed, or any of the above, and you are only with ASCAP or BMI, you are missing out on that money. Now, back in the day, in the pre-digital era, you would have to sign to a publishing company to get that money. But now I'm very obsessed with Songtrust. Because Downtown is sponsoring this episode because I've been so obsessed with Songtrust. Downtown owns Songtrust, but that came out very organically. Songtrust has democratized music publishing. So now you can go sign up with Songtrust and collect on the rest of your publishing. So does that answer your question? Are you confused when on ASCAP, or sorry, you're with BMI, on BMI that...
No, it was just okay. More so like if me and you do a song, yeah, for example, and we agree 60-40.
I see.
And the songwriting / composition, yeah, part should be 60 and the publishing should also be 60.
Yeah.
Or is it, because I've run into that a couple of times.
Sorry, say that one more time because I got distracted by Siri. And I'm so sorry that I gave that very long winded answer, but hopefully you learn from that because it is very important.
Essentially, I'm saying should the two halves equal the same amount?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Wow. That was such a, I'm so sorry that I gave a long-winded answer, but publishing is the number one missing revenue stream. So I'm not sorry. Yes, it needs to add to 100. And that goes back to what Carl and I were talking about with communication. So if you and I are sitting down to write a song or we're hitting the studio, that's why you need to say like, I wrote these songs, or however you want to communicate it. Like if you contribute to the songwriting process, let me know after the session. So you have that conversation, you throw it in an email, you both agree to terms, because you're exactly right. If you think, or it could be a typo, right? If you wrote 60% and I put in 30%, ASCAP's going to be like, well, where's this remaining 10 going, right? So yeah, just make sure everyone's on the same page, but you're just in charge of registering your songwriting split. But yeah, that's a really good question that I haven't thought about. You just... trying to make sure your songwriters have it together because you don't want an admin error to cause a delay in your payments on that song, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Yes, no problem. All right. Well, hopefully we didn't bore you too much with musicians' favorite topic, getting your business affairs together. Come on back on Tuesday where we are finally going to dig into the magic of recording and talk about how to record with or without a budget. Thanks again to my amazing guest, Carl Folks Esquire, and you guys for all of your questions. It's really inspiring. We'll see you on Tuesday.